Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And so we've tried to cultivate, encourage an intellectual culture of various things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. And so when I bundle all that up, if you're a brand new listener, I usually just explain that as we try to be kind and think critically about things. So we want to explore things very rigorously, but we want to appropriately and measuredly sort of do that. So we think being a virtuous Christian thinker includes things like James tells us in James 3, being open to reason and being reasonable about things. So it's not being belligerent, but it doesn't mean that we don't pursue knowledge as a great virtue. And so we talk to all sorts of people on the podcast. It's lots of fun: history, philosophy, theology, all things in between. And today we're going to have sort of a mixture of, I think, all of those, including psychology. So this will be fun. We've got Tim Pickavance, Liz Hall, Aaron Smith, and Jason McMartin with us. And we're going to be talking about emotions and its relationship to quite a few different disciplines. So I don't want to spend any more time talking about myself. I want you guys to introduce me briefly to who you are. So our listeners, I think we know Tim. Tim, you've been on a couple. Have you been on once or twice? I can't remember.
Just once. Yep. This is second time.
So Tim, I'll let you introduce yourself. But just for those who are listening, I mean, like, who are you? What do you teach? And then how'd you get involved? Because I guess I didn't mention this is a Templeton grant was part of funding the research for this. How'd you get involved in that?
Yeah. So I'm Tim Pickavance. I teach philosophy and some courses in theology at Biola University, kind of across from undergrad to grad. And I've been doing that for, gosh, I guess 17 years now. So been at Biola for my work is a lot these days on epistemology and especially the epistemology of emotions. So I think about how emotions forming us in our mind and so on. And then more broadly about anthropology and the way that human beings are and the way that we ought to be. I got into this project because Liz and I often have taught a class for Biola psychology majors called Psychology and Christian Thought that's co-taught between a psychologist and a philosopher or theologian. And we were noticing patterns in our students about the way that students are processing through moral issues that are kind of at the intersection of faith and science and so on. And we were seeing the ways that emotions were kind of driving a lot of that thinking, which we think is not all bad, but it also has a tendency to sort of, you know, dominate the conversation if you have strong emotional reactions. And so part of what we were trying to do through this is think through how we can help people better process their emotions and use them in good ways as they're trying to form judgments about questions of interest to Christians in the moral sphere and connected to science and so on.
Awesome. Liz?
I'm Liz Hall. I teach at Rosemead School of Psychology. My training is in clinical psychology. I've been at Biola for about 26 years. And so for most of that time, I have been teaching that class that Tim describes. I teach three sections of that every semester. And so what got me into this topic? Tim mentioned some of the influences from that class. Another strand is that a few years ago, I started dabbling in the science-religion interface, particularly as psychology has done research in that area. And one of the things that was striking to me, I think, as a clinical psychologist, is how the topic of emotion was virtually absent. Nobody was thinking about how emotion functioned in that space. And again, given my particular training, it seemed like just a glaring omission. And so when the opportunity came to be funded by the Templeton Religion Trust, I thought, Here's my chance. And so that's how this particular project started.
That's awesome. And Aaron, I know Aaron and I, so I feel like I know you pretty well because you were part of the grant here at Southeastern in North Carolina. So we got to hang out a good bit. So Aaron, tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in this one.
Yeah, it's good to be on the podcast and good to see you, Jordan. So I'm Aaron Smith, and I'm the Fletcher Jones Endowed Professor of Research at California Baptist University in Southern California, where I also teach psychology. I've been there since 2011. So my training is as a developmental psychologist, interested in exploring how children and ultimately adults form our boundaries of knowing around especially religion and science. So I come to this project with that as my background, thinking about what are the psychological underpinnings of how we even engage in things we can't necessarily see directly, which most of science and much of our religious beliefs and content falls into those categories. Doesn't mean we don't have a reason for knowing, but it's not something that we can kind of easily verify through direct experience. And so when Liz and Jason and Tim were pursuing this project, they invited me to join, really thinking about just the science-religion interface generally and how it is more than the content of organizing our knowledge of science and our knowledge of theological doctrine, that there's more to it that is at this perceived conflict where they meet.
Jason?
Yeah, so I'm Jason McMartin. I'm also at Biola, and I have a dual appointment here between the School of Psychology and the undergraduate division of the School of Theology. In my graduate role at Rosemead, I teach theology to doctoral students in clinical psychology, and so I end up interfacing with the psychologists quite a bit. At the undergrad level, I also teach that class with Liz, Psychology and Christian Thought, so that's one connection that I have to the project. Another is that Tim and I had already done some work on epistemology and emotions that we've been thinking about for quite a while, and that kind of led into making some connections with what we're doing on this project. And then kind of the other thing that I spend quite a bit of time on these days is finding meaning in the midst of suffering, which is another project that I'm working on with Liz. And that's another kind of big area of research for me right now.
That's awesome. I mean, I feel like the topic of this, I mean, what the actual title of the grant, tell me if I'm wrong, The Role of Emotions in Christians' Perceptions of Science, right? I mean, I feel like just the title alone is like, wow, there's a massive ocean of opportunity here. I mean, when I think of Christians and science, it's almost like all the exclusive energy goes to how old is the earth? And I'm like, okay, can we please spend some time thinking about something else? So, I mean, maybe from the broadest perspective, like what are the key sort of areas that you guys have been developing and researching that you would say this is the most valuable resources that we've been able to engage so far? I don't know who wants to start with these sort of questions. So feel free to jump in, whoever feels like they've got something to share.
My vote is for a psychologist.
I mean, I think you're right that a lot of the perceived energy, especially in the academy, is around things like the age of the earth or how evolution might fit with the biblical account. And you're right. That's exactly my reaction to it. It's like, who cares? Sorry, I shouldn't say that probably on a podcast like this. But, you know,
you can say that on my podcast. I agree.
In terms of lived experience, it feels like there's all kinds of things that affect us much more directly. And a lot of those have to do with scientific technologies that are now emerging, and a lot of them have to do with technologies that involve the human body. And it seems like a lot of the things that like hit the news in recent years have been precisely at that interface, the interface of just kind of emerging technologies that have to do with adjustments or changes or infiltrating the human body, and that a lot of people seem to have reactions to. And so that is I think, the sweet spot where we wanted to spend our time.
Yes.
Aaron, go ahead.
You, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add that, you know, we're kind of in a cultural moment where on the one hand, there's this strong current that's telling us that your emotions don't matter. So that's kind of like the Enlightenment instinct is still fairly strong. And so you find people saying you should kind of ignore your emotions as you're trying to think rationally about something or consider the truth of a thing. And on the other hand, you've got this very strong cultural current that's maybe more kind of coming from the Romantic period or something, where the guiding light of your life is your gut or your feelings or your emotions. And these two things have got to both be wrong. But there's not a lot of care given to understanding how to think about your emotions when you're trying to think well without being dominated by them. And so a big part of what we're trying to do, in light of what Liz was just describing about all of these really interesting technological innovations that are creating moral conundrums for Christians and non-Christians alike, is to help people think about how to use their emotions to guide their pursuit of truth without being dominated by them and thinking that they have nothing to do with reality. And there's a lot of really interesting philosophical and theological and psychological work about this, but no one has taken the time to sort of put that together and offer it as kind of a package to help people work through those things. So that's a big part of what we're trying to accomplish in taking this up, is not just address particular issues, but offer people a framework so that as they're processing new things that are arising, guided by the scriptures and by the best of theology and by the best of psychology, how to think through those new things down the road, not just right now.
I mean, I'll just ask a question here, and maybe it derails it, and maybe it's a bomb. But I mean, when I think about emotions, I think there's probably a growing segment of Christians, probably more men would think this, but they would think emotions just are bad universally. You shouldn't have emotions. You should always seek to dominate your emotions, essentially. So Tim, it seemed like you're trying to explain, like, you want to have like the control them appropriately and direct them. But I think there's a growing trend to say, like, there's nothing good in emotions. You should be completely stoic, I guess. So is that an appropriate response based on what you guys have been doing? Or is there a different sort of path that Christians should be approaching it?
From a psychological perspective, it's actually impossible not to function without relying on our emotions. And so that kind of rhetoric around masculinity, the only thing it does is forces people to be out of touch with these forces that are really shaping a lot of how they perceive the world and judge the world. And so I would say that that's a huge ideological handicap that we're handing to the men in our circles, because the research shows that without relying on our emotions, we literally can't even like decide what we want for breakfast or, much less make intelligent decisions in the world, because they have such a huge role, especially in motivation. So one of the side effects of that rhetoric that tells men that they just have to stuff it deep, deep down inside is that it ends up leaking out in unhelpful ways, usually in the form of anger or aggression. That tends to be where all the emotions eventually get funneled when they're not able to be expressed, acknowledged, and expressed appropriately. Which, of course, causes then its own problems in terms of how men are thinking about their masculinity.
Yeah. So in psychology, there's a framework, and this is what I'm about to describe is an oversimplification, but it's good as a heuristic, that we have these two modes of engaging. Sometimes this is under the umbrella of what's called a dual processing theory, that we have this system one, which is kind of our quick automatic gut reactions, our heuristic thinking. So when you step up to the counter and they say, do you want to supersize that? Like the answer just comes out and you can't even, you don't know, it's just automatic. And the system two is this like rational computational system and process where you're going to apply some more of these algorithmic step one, step two to arrive at a full, robust, reasoned response. So when they ask you that question, you might run through a calculation of the cost to calorie to goals, and you run through all that and you're going to be there forever. So that's why we don't use system two in that circumstance. But the thing is that the way that these systems interact is emotions, although they exist and they kind of are pervasive throughout both of these styles of thinking, what system two is really good at is telling you what is out there, right? And so it can help kind of document and put all the pieces on the table. What are the decisions that need to be made? What are the pieces that are part of this decision? And in the real world, it's that system one, especially that the emotional parts that help prioritize what's the most important piece of information. And so if we want to ignore that emotional input, it's still going to impact our reasoning just in a way that we are blind to. And I tend to be of the camp that that blindness is actually worse than an open acknowledgement of I'm having these feelings. Now, how do I use the information that these feelings are giving me to act according to my values and to choose according to my values and to prioritize all the relevant pieces of information? And so Liz had mentioned the connection between emotions and motivations. And that's really what I mean here by that prioritization, that when we have these emotional reactions, it tells us what's the most important thing to do first, to do right now. What's the action I should take now that I have all of this information that's been laid out from that rational system to thinking.
Do you live in North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, Florida, Alabama, Indiana, Michigan, or Oklahoma? I imagine some of you do who are listening to this right now. Well, if you live there and you've considered at any point of buying a house or potentially refinancing for whatever reason you may need, if you need some cash or if you'd like a lower rate based on what you have, you should contact us at professorlending.com. So if you've ever wondered about buying a home, you don't know where to start, or if you're considering buying, or if you have friends buying, or if you've ever thought about refinancing, you should give us a shout. We'll take care of you. We'll make sure that you get the best possible deal, as well as that you're educated on all your possible options. So let us know. I would love to help you if that is something that's on the horizon for you or a friend or a family member. We'll take care of them, and you will have the best experience you've ever had with buying or refinancing a home.
Hey
If I can just add something just less psychologically, though, I mean, it's psychological adjacent, but the history of theology is littered with theologians. I mean, the great theologians of the church have all spent extraordinary energy trying to understand the role of feeling and affect and emotion in guiding the life of a Christian. So even from a Christian perspective, it doesn't really make any sense to say we should just stuff our emotions or ignore them or not attend to them. Even from a theological standpoint, I mean, whatever else you think of people like Augustine and Aquinas and Jonathan Edwards and all the other sort of great theologians of the church, they were very attentive to the emotional side of our experience. And they seemed to think that cultivating that was an important part of our devotion to Christ. And I mean, just the idea of devotion, if you're just cold, that's not devotion in the sense that you find in the Christian tradition. And you read, even in the scriptures, you read Jesus and Paul and Peter and James, they're very clear. David, and I mean, go back into the Old Testament, they all have massive feels. and they don't just sort of like let that dictate to them how to be, but they aren't denying that aspect of themselves because it's part of what it means to live as a human in the world, that you have these feelings and experiences and you're meant to sort of grow in those ways too. I mean, growth in love is not just about your mind. It is about your mind, but it's about more than your mind. And that's clear both in the scriptures and the theological tradition. And so part of what needs to happen these days is a recovery of those kinds of things and a reintegration of that into these conversations. Because as you said, Jordan, the end point of that idea that you were describing is domination, which is exactly what Liz is pointing out. I mean, this stuff will leak. So you want to actually learn how to sort of live with it and cultivate it and be guided by it in the right ways, understanding that it's a fallen part of us just like every other part. And so we have to work to grow in those spaces as well.
Tim, you just used a couple of words, affection and I guess feeling and some different terms. I guess there's a twofold question. One is, how much did the invention of the terminology of emotion make things more confusing for us when we're trying to think theologically about certain things? And I guess the other question is related is, you're all at Protestant institutions. Did you find that Catholics were ahead of us and sort of like taxonomies of like working out some of this stuff? Or are we both in the same bucket of being behind the times on being able to like properly understand where emotions fit? And I don't know who should answer that question, but I'm just throwing it out there.
I'm happy to answer your first question in terms of how complicated did the term emotion make things. Quite a lot. So it's a relatively new vintage. Really seems to have only arisen in the late 1800s. And it sort of bears with it already a kind of pointer towards a passivity that emotions are things that happen to us and are not active. And if that's true, then it tends to push them out of the realm of moral evaluation, which is part of the reason why we're having some of these issues that we've just been discussing. Because if it's just something that happens to you and you're completely passive and involuntary with respect to it, doesn't seem like you can be morally evaluated with respect to it. And if you can't, then it doesn't seem like it works in that function either, or at least its moral information that it provides to you about the world seems suspect and it seems to cut you off from that moral evaluation information that you can gain from the world. If you look back at the tradition, so the word that Tim used, you know, most typically the words that are used are affections and passions, though even those words are used somewhat variously by the theologians and philosophers of the past. So that doesn't necessarily help entirely, but it does kind of help us think a little bit about our cultural moment and kind of the way we even perceive emotions at all. There's sort of a built-in conceptuality that has been, in a lot of ways, dominated by the social sciences. And I don't say that, you know, in a way that's meant to be disparaging, but it does mean it kind of gives a certain flavor or color to the way we think about emotions typically that I do think takes us off the rails in certain ways.
Now, on the second question, Jordan, I think it might be that these days the Catholic sort of philosophical and theological tradition has kept up with some of those conversations. I mean, I'm sure if you ask a Thomist or whatever, they're going to, you know, just say, well, Thomas figured all this out, and so we don't need to worry about it anymore. But I will say in the tradition, though, Protestants were talking about this too. I mean, Jonathan Edwards comes to mind as sort of a clear case of someone whose entire theology, at least of the spiritual life, was organized around the idea of affection. But even going on into the 20th century, someone like C.S. Lewis was very attentive to these things. I mean, if you look at his work in Abolition of Man and like Men Without Chests, for example, he talks about the chest as the sort of meeting point of what we would think of as the mind and what we would think of as the gut. And he thinks that the problem of the modern world is that people don't have chests, but chests are an affective thing. That they're not just a cognitive thing. They're not just a gut level thing. They're the combination of those things where you've got both content and also sort of a movement of the will. And this is exactly what people like, you know, in the more classical tradition would have been describing when they talk about the interaction of mind and will and the way that that shapes our life. So it's a rejection both of a kind of Humean, only driven by your feelings kind of idea, and your mind is just helping you figure out how to get there, and a rejection of a kind of more rationalist thing where you just think about what's good and you ignore, you know, what you feel. So even people in the 20th century like Lewis are doing this. And so you find, and the person who brought the conversation of emotions into the philosophical conversation very strongly was a Protestant thinker, Robert Roberts. And so there is a sort of tradition on both sides of this, but there are these counterweights that are pushing in other directions. So it's not just a sort of lack in the Protestant tradition, I don't think. I think there's those strands there. It's just that, you know, the popular consciousness of this stuff has been lost for whatever reason. I'm not totally sure of why that is.
Makes sense. Go ahead, Erin, did you have something to add?
Well, yeah, but it's not as academically grounded as what Jason and Tim just said. So I just speaking out of a little bit out of my own experience, that the way that our churches sometimes just don't engage the questions of emotions leaves us to be discipled by our culture in a way that can exacerbate our sense that, you know, feelings are either to be ignored and dominated, leaving us with the stoicism that we've already said probably isn't the right pathway, or to just be dominated by our emotions, right? Follow my heart, because that's where all truth lies. The truth is already in me. I just have to kind of figure out how to follow it right. And so I think that there is a real, not universally, but definitely places where a lack of intentional discipleship on these issues just comes out, where we don't, it's not even a part of our conversation. And I think that's a problem.
Now, I think earlier on, before we started recording, Liz, I think it was you who mentioned the, I guess, primacy of anger in some of the research that you have been doing. I'd love for you to sort of expand on that, because I think that's really interesting. And I think we've talked a little bit about anger, but I'd love to hear more about what you guys have been working on with it.
Since we're interested in emotions, the group of emotions that we landed on were what we call the other-oriented moral emotions. And so when we went into this project, we suspected that anger would probably drive a lot of what we found, but we were also thinking that disgust and contempt might be pretty big players. And so those were the three emotions that we were paying particular attention to in this project. But it turns out that contempt and disgust kind of fell by the wayside, that when we asked participants to read kind of morally charged vignettes and then report on how they were feeling and then report on what they would like to do and how they judged the technologies, that pretty much anger was the driving force there. Anger was the thing that really contributed to the types of outcomes that we saw. So that was a little puzzling. Erin and I spent some time talking about that. We wondered whether it's because in Christian circles, we can kind of baptize anger as a kind of righteous anger and feel justified in expressing that in some way. And it's harder to get away with that in terms of contempt and disgust. So we wondered whether there might not be some kind of cleaning up of the affect that was happening and channeling it into a kind of justified righteous anger.
Yeah. So in our research, Liz kind of mentioned it, that we had participants, all Christian participants, read about different kinds of scientific technologies. But what makes this an actual kind of empirical project is that some of them were read about a technology that was explicitly framed to try to rile up some sense of anger And then other participants read about the exact same technology that was presented in a more what we might call emotionally neutral way. And we did all the pre-testing to make sure that these were equivalent in all sorts of ways. And so the exact same technology, when it was presented in a way that increased someone's experience of anger, led to a further distancing of that person and the science. So they described much more willingness to be antagonistic toward that science, toward the scientists themselves. It kind of came with this package of I don't want to deal with that scientific technology. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to engage it. And in some circumstances, I actually want to be actively against it. But when participants read about that same technology in a more balanced, neutral way, they didn't have those same reactions. And so this is where we're talking about the link between emotions and action, that it's not necessarily inherent in the technology, but rather our response to that technology. And if you think about the way that most of us get information about science, it's through clickbait titles that are designed to rile our emotions. And so it is not an accident that we have really strong reactions to tweet-length claims that we just kind of run across in our daily life, because they're designed to activate this kind of moral outrage, of which anger is a really important part. But when we get that same technology without that anger, it changes our response patterns.
So what are some examples of these technologies they'd be presented with?
So we gave three scenarios that we, again, did some pilot testing to figure out which were the ones that were the most morally evocative. So we didn't do anything having to do with age of the earth or evolution, because as we talked about, there's actually some good research that suggests these get a lot of smoke, but not a lot of heat, and that these are kind of shallow end issues. But when you really start getting into where there's meaningful potential for kind of cross dialogue between science and religious traditions, you end up in places where science interacts with the human body. And so we asked participants to reflect on gender affirming treatments in children. That was the most morally provocative of our scenarios, as well as two that had to do with kind of technology and brain interfaces. And so I'm only thinking of our shorthand for them, but not the actual content. So Liz, maybe if you remember, you can say more.
Well, AI implants.
Yeah.
And then we also looked at whole brain emulation. Those were the two that we landed on.
I am very intrigued by the results that you've been able to get from all three of these. I mean, just my hunch is I'm anticipating that the gender related stuff, there's probably more universal agreement on that. And then the implant would probably be after that, if I'm guessing. And then finally, the last one, sort of like, I guess, I don't know, emulation or whatever. Am I close to the results that you guys are finding?
The AI implants and the whole brain emulation were actually fairly close. And then, of course, the gender-affirming care was way up there in terms of the people's outrage. I think because, well, whole brain emulation at this point, it's just a theoretical possibility. Nobody's actually done it yet, of course. And I think even AI implants, people hear about them maybe on the news, but it's not something that the person, you know, on the next block over has undergone. Whereas I think the gender affirming care for children is something that we all know somebody, or somebody that we know knows somebody, where these are very live issues that people are having to wrestle through.
Yeah, I think when I think of AI implants, I immediately think of all the jokes about like the signs on people's foreheads, or, you know, I have a Whole Foods next to my work. So my friends always make fun of me for going to Whole Foods or whatever. But, you know, they've got the palm thing. You can pay with your palm. And that's like the sign of the end times or something like that. I guess that's, I don't know if you get the outrage emotion there as much as you get the, you know, make fun of emotion, whatever that is.
Well, so I'll just say our goal in this isn't to, like, we're not advocating one way or another in these scenarios. We just want to know what are the things that people, when they hear about this technology, that cause a reaction that's actually really counterproductive for meaningful, faithful interaction in the public square. And so when we have exposure to these live wire issues that activate all of these moral emotions like anger, and then that causes us to lash out, to react, to fight, to protect, because these are the impulses that anger motivates, to what extent does that actually prevent us from being able to access all of the information that's relevant to a well-reasoned Christian engagement with the topic at hand?
Just to kind of carry on with that, just to kind of go into a more sort of epistemological space there, the one thing that I think is clear both in the psychology of emotions, but also when you get into the philosophical side of things, is that emotions are big attention shapers. They shape in profound ways, like what it is that we notice in our environment, what kinds of things we're attentive to and not attentive to. So, I mean, there are sort of patterns in these things. These aren't universally true, but generally speaking, negative emotions like anger tend to focus your attention, or fear. And then there's some evidence anyway that more positive emotions like joy and those kinds of things broaden your attention. And so those kinds of attention changes make a really big difference in what you're going to wind up thinking is true, because you're going to be taking in different information. So two people with different affective lives and different affective reactions might be responding differently to a question, not because one of them is being irrational and the other one is, you know, is being perfectly rational, but just because they've taken in different information while observing the same evidence and environment and all of that kind of stuff, based on the way that these ideas make them feel. And that can be there's a rationality in that, and it's something that's good and important. Like if you're feeling afraid, it's really important that your mind is being focused to try to find the thing that's causing the fear. That's not bad, but it also can lead us, if we're not careful, to make conclusions in a sort of hasty way, or to miss out on things, to sort of not take the time to learn from those who are seeing the world in a perhaps slightly different way. Where we want to go with this then is trying to say, okay, let's acknowledge these things, recognize the role that they play in these kinds of ways, and then take a minute and just try to learn from the people in our communities about what we might have missed and what we might not have missed, and actually help others and allow them to help us, so that we together can form, you know, more careful and considered judgments about these things, taking stock of not just our emotions, but all the other reasons we might have for believing.
You know, this is actually where I really appreciate the interdisciplinary nature of our project. I think as psychologists, sometimes we look at what is in the world, what exists, and we might be a little fatalistic. It's kind of like, well, that's the way that moral judgments work. Well, so then you have people like Tim and Jason who are saying, hold on, this means that there's an opportunity here for discipling our emotions, for discipling our gut. And I think that's what we are really hoping for in terms of the outcomes of this project, is to just help move that project along a little bit more, making people aware of this opportunity and providing some tools for that.
So you mentioned some tools and resources. I mean, maybe somebody sort of like walk me through some of the things that you've been able to develop, and if and where they're available.
So the main product we have at this point is a kind of guide that we have put together for use in groups, whether that be in colleges or church groups or that kind of thing. We've entitled it Faithful Reasoning, A Christian's Guide to Engaging Controversial Scientific Topics. Although I should say, as kind of a side note here, we actually expect that this process will be helpful with engaging all kinds of different controversial topics. But we've tried to put together what we know about the way that humans function from psychology, and then all of this really great epistemological work that Tim and Jason did. And we've come up with a series of kind of six steps that people can thoughtfully work through in a group context around a particular topic. So this is available as a series of slides that a guide can put together. And basically, we have a script that they can guide people through, and then a workbook so that people can be in a group working together around these kind of controversial topics. In terms of where it's available, what our intent is to make this kind of freely and widely available. So one of the places where most likely it will be available is on Erin Smith's website. Maybe she can give that link a little later on. But we'll also be putting it in various other places so that hopefully it will be easily accessible to people who are interested.
And just for what it's worth, I mean, the part of the conditions of the grant is that this stuff is free. I mean, we're not allowed to sell it. We, you know, the granting agency, the Templeton Religion Trust, has told us, you know, part of the agreement was that we would give it away. And so there's no cost to sort of get what we've produced, which is something we're happy about.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, if somebody like wants a, like a physical workbook, are they just going to like print it out themselves, or is there a location they can get it? Like,
yeah, I think they need to print it. But okay. I will say it's really well done. One of the things that we've been working on, the reason it's not currently posted is because we're finishing up the formatting. But thinking about somebody who themselves is working through this issue, the way that the presenter guide is written is with just a little bit of review. It's really like a plug and play where there is a script, there's additional background information that you can read to prepare ahead of time, but you don't have to be an expert to lead others. And then the workbook clearly aligns that during a maybe 1.5 hour session, there's times built in consistently throughout the workshop to say, okay, now take 5 minutes and work through this question and then turn to your neighbor and have this conversation. And then we're going to come back and we're going to keep moving through those steps. So it's not meant to be something where we just say, oh yeah, emotions matter, learn some words and then do nothing different. But really it's meant to be this actual practice and ongoing improvement of thinking through these controversial issues with an acknowledgement of our emotions as part of, but just part of this process.
And we've also just one more thing. We've got to kind of set up as a sort of circular process, because the idea is not that you would go through this one time and be done. The idea is that it's signaling a kind of cycle that we ought to continually be going through as we learn more and you know, as we change and grow and sort of discover new things. We want to show people how to incorporate that into this kind of ongoing process of continual movement toward reality and both understanding ourselves and also appreciating what's going on out in the world. And so, you know, it's kind of structured in a way that allows you to kind of keep going once you're done. And I think that's important. That's just kind of how we are and how we ought to be. And so we want to sort of be, you know, always in that process of growth. Yeah.
So I have a question. I mean, the test thing you guys have been doing, basically, you know, where you have a difference between emotionally charged and sort of not emotionally charged. I mean, when I think about social media, like it seems like, you know, it's intentionally like trying to evoke certain emotions, like you everybody I think sees and understands. Is the advice get off social media because there's like no way to avoid it, or is there like some way to like somehow become like an extremely virtuous person that is able to engage these things appropriately? Because it seems like, I mean, the way it's designed is like intentionally appealing to sort of like a vicious cycle of things. And I don't know who's virtuous enough to be able to handle the amount of stuff you're getting inundated with there. So what's the appropriate sort of recourse to engaging that form of content?
Getting off social media is not the worst idea in the world, because you're right. I mean, it is pulling and it is structured around certain things, and its structures don't facilitate the kind of reflective process that we're encouraging here. But of course, probably the real answer is something like moderation.
Well, and I think also understanding yourself, that different people, I mean, so you've talked about like who is virtuous enough to engage well. I think that's part of it. But also virtuous people are also different people. We have different personalities, we have different proclivities and experiences that we can say to kind of like, let's hold all things equal, equally mature, virtuous Christians might arrive at a different answer to that question. And actually, that could be a good case study for a controversial topic to work through these steps with. That's not necessarily specific to science, but how do you come to a conclusion that might change over time as you think about, should I or should I not be engaging in social media? Because there are certainly benefits and there's also a lot of drawbacks. And so does any one individual kind of weigh these various factors for them in their context, in their relationship, in their ecosystem? And so I'm not sure there is a clear kind of, this is the one answer that everybody ought to adopt.
I mean, I'm thinking based on what Aaron is saying about that passage in Proverbs, those back-to-back verses that say, return the fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Don't return the fool according to his folly, lest he become like him. And that kind of idea, what that I think is doing is it's showing that in a lot of these kinds of moral questions, there's an opportunity and a danger. And part of what discernment requires is understanding, you know, how your own heart and the heart of the people that you're engaged with are situated with respect to those opportunities and dangers. So when confronted with a fool, the opportunity is that you can draw him or her out of his or her foolishness, the danger is you might become a fool, right? And so depending on your own heart and what your proclivities are and your tendencies and what you know about them, and you know, that will shape the way, and wisdom requires that you kind of, you know, attend to those kinds of things. And so in a process like this, I mean, some of what you might learn is, well, for me right now, this is a bad idea, but I don't have to think that for them right now, it's also a bad idea. And that's part of what wisdom requires, and why we have lots of members in the church, right? Because I think we need a Christian presence in a lot of these places, but we don't want people that aren't equipped to be there and who will be led into foolishness or sort of, you know, destruction to be in those spaces. And so we have to sort of discern ourselves and discern our community, you know, who's going to be where and when. And I think, like Aaron was saying, that might even change over time, right? You might grow in certain ways that would allow you to engage in those spaces a lot more healthily. I mean, I think we know that, for example, social media is worse for certain demographics than it is for others. And so that should matter.
I will say, even without saying yes or no to social media in general, I would say that any mature, virtuous engagement is not going to be accidental. That it will be reflective and intentional with a consistent revisiting of how is this forming or deforming me. But it won't just be, this is what everybody does, so I'm doing it too. That posture is inconsistent. Whatever the ultimate choice is for any given time, what Tim is describing is this kind of intentional thinking through and deciding, and then intentional revisiting of that process and decision.
Yeah. So if people want to learn more about all this stuff, besides like getting the resources that you've created, I'm imagining you all probably... Does anybody else have a website with their own works that are listed that I can tell people that they need to go to? I mean, Tim, you have is it Pancake Victim or something? Where can people go to find out more about what you're doing personally and the work that you've been doing and will be doing in the future as well?
So I have a Substack. If you just Google my name, Tim Pickavance, or if an anagram of Tim Pickavance is Pancake Victim. So no one knows how to spell Pickavance. So anyway, if you go to pancakevictim.substack.com or just pancakevictim.com, it'll take you to my Substack. That's free. And if people can't afford to get behind the paywall, stuff goes behind a paywall after a while, I'm happy to comp people or whatever. And I'm planning to sort of, you know, that's sort of a newslettery kind of thing. And once we've got a website up and running with these materials, you know, available, I'll be sort of, you know, pushing that out there. So that's one way. And the work that Jason and I have done on emotions, we've got one paper out and one or two others that are sort of in the works. That one is freely available. Again, you can sort of find that by finding me or Jason. You know, it's not hard, but we've got a paper called Affective Reason that's more nerdy philosophy kind of related to this project. And we've been sort of carting these ideas around to conferences and so on. But there's more to come, and it will kind of roll out, at least on my end, on that side. It has an actual website.
I have a website in process, so I can't lead anyone there at this point, but we'll put the materials there for sure, and also make the article that Aaron and I worked on freely available and on one of our websites. Aaron, though, is the one who actually does have a website.
I know, but that makes it sound very official. It's aaronsmithpsychology.com, and I make it myself. So anchor your expectations accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, Jason, do you even have a website? I don't even think you have a website, do you? You're a ghost online. I love that about you.
So, Jason, do you have a computer or a phone?
He has to borrow mine when we do these things, you know? Yeah. He was the last person I know to get a smartphone. This is why Jason is the best among us, I think, and arguably, you know? Yeah.
So, Jason, if people want to find your work, do they just Google your name? Is there any special thing that people need to remember to be able to find you?
Well, some of the same things that Tim was mentioning already, I suppose. But I too, am going to get a website this summer. So.
Oh.
Aw.
Excellent. So, you know, people listen to these things way after the fact. So if you're listening in 6 months from now, maybe you need to Google and the website will be ready for everybody.
There you go.
But I really appreciate you guys doing this. This was a lot of fun. It seems like there's a ton of opportunity and research available here, as well as practical application. So go check out the resources that they mentioned, because it sounds like that'd be really useful for a lot of different contexts, whether it's church or other small groups and other related material. So thanks for the labors you've done here. everybody's been listening, make sure to check out their work. Pancake Victim. I mean, I still love that. The fact that I remember that tells you it's sticky. So you've got something going for you.
I've got a logo and everything, Jordan.
Yeah. You know? I mean, how can you beat that? So everybody's been listening. Thanks for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you all soon.